The Capital Investment Committee hearing for April 4th is called to order. Members, we do not have a quorum, and so we'll start with our agenda. For our testifiers, we are allotted 5 minutes for your presentation. And first off, we have Representative Burko, and I just want to say welcome back to Mayor Fabian.
Thank you.
Please proceed, Representative Burko.
Thank you, Chair Lee and committee members, for this informational hearing on House File 2450. You'll see in your packets a couple of handouts. The city of Roseville is looking to eliminate a current flooding problem on the west side of the city. The solution they're looking for is to upsize the storm sewer system serving that side of the city so it can be a little more resilient during these more frequent heavy rain events they've seen. Back in the summer of 2019, a rain event occurred in the city of Roseville, creating a significant flooding of the Polaris manufacturing facility, resulting in a 24-hour shutdown. Also affected a low-income housing area, which has now become kind of a fairly frequent event there. MnDOT also has programmed a reconstruction, and if you look on your maps, you'll see on the south side of town, Highway 89 coming in. The reconstruction of Highway 89 through the city is scheduled for 2027. However, the storm sewer capacity improvements are required to accommodate and protect the proposed highway investment. So with that, I'm going to just turn this over to my testifier. He's been here before. I'll let Mayor Fabian explain things a little
Please
further.
Please identify yourself, Mr. Mayor, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Dan Fabian. I'm currently the mayor of Roseville, Minnesota. For those of you that don't know, Roseville is located about 360 miles north and a little west of here, 12 miles south of the Canadian border, and our population is about roughly 2,750 people. I'm here today to ask you to support House File 2450, which is a bill that's going to help fund a project that's going to relieve some flooding that is occurring currently. It floods our West Side Trailer Park. It floods our Center Street that goes west of Highway 89. As John, Representative Burko, mentioned, in 2019, we had a substantial rainstorm, and the water backs up onto the floor of the Polaris manufacturing plant, which results in a shutdown and people being sent home. Currently, we are experiencing the flooding, but one of the big drivers behind this project, as is in the letter that I provided for you, is the reconstruction of Highway 89. Currently, Highway 89 comes into Roseville from the south, and it's about a mile long coming up to Highway 11. And it's a rural highway. So in front of the Polaris manufacturing plant, in front of the Brick House restaurant and the Polaris Experience Center and the Dollar General store, and then on the other side some residential stuff and our Ford dealership, they're just regular ditches. There are no curb and gutter, no storm sewers, and the ditches don't flow very well. They get filled up with debris and cattails and so forth. So MnDOT, in that effort to restore or improve Highway 89, has said that they will not advance that project if we don't do something to address the additional stormwater that's going to occur during heavy rains as a result of the construction. So what we're asking for is a share from the state for about $1.9 million that will fund roughly half the project. This will increase our stormwater capacity to get rid of the stormwater, run it through a pipe. There's already one pipe there. The engineers have recommended the second pipe that will be about a 4 foot in diameter that will carry a substantial increase in stormwater, about 1,500 feet down to a retention pond, and then from there it's released in a timely manner into the Roseville River. So without this, Project 89 doesn't get done, and you can imagine in a town of 2,700 people, we do not have the financial resources to be able to make a project like this without substantial help from hopefully the state of Minnesota and the federal government. Mr. Chair, thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mayor Fabian, I know that I was copying on a few email exchanges between you and the DNR regarding the flood hazard mitigation, and so I'm just curious, if we were to pass the bill that's over at the center right now, House File 669, with the $15 million in flood hazard mitigation, are you top of the list to receive any funds if that goes through, or are you not able to get funding through that program?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question, and I think I heard you say $15 million. Is that correct? I just wanted to be clear. No, we are not on that list, and that was a part of the email string that you referred to. And I understand, you know, kind of how the system works. I was actively involved in flood mitigation stuff for Northwest Minnesota, the Red River Valley, in my entire 10 years. And it's a critical issue. There are a few projects once in a while that do surface. DNR did not have us on their list, largely because we weren't aware that we were going to be pursuing this until after we got the report from MnDOT and so forth. And because of that situation, we hadn't filed papers with DNR. We are in the process of doing that now, but currently, no, we are not. And so then the $15 million would not get to our project. Thank you.
Thank you for that information, Mayor.
Yep.
Representative Erdahl.
No, I was just...
Oh. Sounds good. Representative Berko, any closing comments?
Thank you, Chair Lee. Nothing extensive other than just reconstruction of that storm sewer would just provide the necessary improvements to let the Highway 89 project go forward and eliminate this current flooding problem. So just thanks to the Capital Investment Committee for their informational hearing today, and hopefully have your support in the future.
Mayor Fabian.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just want to say thanks, and it's really fun to see some smiling, happy, friendly faces here at the table. You know, my former colleagues and so forth. It's nice to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity. I don't want to break up your committee by walking around shaking hands with everybody, but it is fun to be here. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you again for making the drive down this morning.
Yep.
Next on the agenda, Representative Frazier, House File 1576. Welcome, Representative Frazier. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chair, and I appreciate the time that the committee is giving today to talk about this House file and the the opportunity to move forward on this project, the Blue Line Rail Extension. Just on a personal note, my wife and my kids and I, we moved to the area in anticipation that the Blue Line would be completed by now and having the opportunity to have access to downtown Minneapolis and then connect to St. Paul as well to enjoy the things that we like to do. And also, but the main thing here is what this extension will do is provide for an opportunity for the communities in the northwest suburbs going through up into Brooklyn Park to have access to downtown Minneapolis, have access to affordable housing, and to really kind of instill more of the vibrant communities that we want in our cities in Minnesota. So I have here with me Commissioner Lundy, and I believe our mayor of Brooklyn Park, the largest city in the area, will be joining us as well at some point. We're a little bit behind, but I'm going to let them speak to what this project means. And
so before we go to the commissioner, Representative Frazier, I understand you have the A1 amendment too. Can you briefly explain that?
That is correct. The A1 amendment will deal with, many may be familiar when we had the project here in St. Paul. It will deal with any types of, to address any concerns of displacement of businesses and disruptions of communities in the area. The A1 amendment will help deal with those issues.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Welcome, Commissioner. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee. My name is Jeff Lyon. I'm Hennepin County Commissioner for District 1. I want to thank Representative Frazier for his continued partnership and commitment to this project. Hennepin County seeks to serve our residents by investing in a comprehensive transit network with high-frequency transit lines like light rail and bus rapid transit that meet the needs of our diverse communities. Quality transit is key to building vibrant and connected communities, increasing access to jobs, reducing racial disparities, combating climate change, and providing travel options for everyone. The Blue Line Extension LRT will connect Brooklyn Park through Crystal, Robbinsdale, North Minneapolis to downtown Minneapolis, and more importantly, the broader transit network. The communities served are transit-reliant, racially diverse, and have felt the lasting impacts of historic redlining and disinvestment. Hennepin County is partnering with local municipalities and the Met Council to ensure the project benefits corridor residents by advancing a robust anti-displacement and community wealth-building strategy that center community voices and stakeholders. We also continue to deepen and broaden our commitment to these areas through investments in affordable housing and access to home ownership, transit-oriented development, and support to entrepreneurs and small businesses. Light rail projects are generationally investments in our region's transportation system. The Blue Line Extension will employ thousands of good-paying construction jobs and ignite economic development along the corridor in job, retail, and residential density around stations. There has already been more than $9 billion in development built near existing and planned light rail stations in the region, with more in the pipeline. The state's investment will make our region more competitive for the jobs and talent of the future and will help Minnesota leverage nearly $1 billion for the Federal Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. Again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Commissioner. Seeing no questions, Representative Frazier, any closing comments?
Just that this project is a long time coming. I hope that I am around to see the completion of this project. I think it will mean a lot for the communities. Communities that the rail will have an impact on. I think it will have an interim. You just heard the commissioner testify to the number of jobs it would bring. I just think the economic impact will be huge, and the way that it will facilitate vibrant communities will be a valuable impact on the state of Minnesota as a whole.
So, Representative Frazier, we do have a question. My apologies. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Frazier. Sorry, I just thought I should maybe bring this up. Your appropriation, $200 million, a fair amount of money in a bonding bill, even in a bonding bill. Is there a way that this can be phased in? Do you actually need the $200 million in one bill?
Representative Frazier or Commissioner?
I think we're open to working with the committee to whatever furthers the goal of everyone. So I think, you know, we are working on the project now, but we're grateful for any investment that the state of Minnesota is willing to make in our project.
Representative Erdahl.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. So we can note that this could be phased.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. And thank you, Representative Frazier, for coming by today.
Thank you, Chair.
Next on the agenda, we have House File 1359. Representative Byrd. Welcome back, Representative Byrd. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Lee, Vice Chair Ryer, members of the committee, so great to be back here. I miss not being on the committee this year, but I appreciate the chance that you've given us to present this bill. House File 1359 is a bill about our community. And I just want to sort of paint a picture of what this project means. Highway 13 in Nicollet is one of the busiest and most dangerous intersections in Burnsville. It comes right off of Nicollet, where there is businesses, apartment buildings, the orange line ends there, and then across the street, across Highway 13, is the transit station. So this is a highly used intersection. The exchange for 35 is right there, and up Highway 13 is the high school. So our families, our students, our business members, guests to our city are going to use this intersection. And it is incredibly dangerous. There is access for people walking or biking or walking their dogs to get across Highway 13 to the businesses that are behind there. It's an equity issue for folks who only have transportation in terms of biking or walking. And so we are looking to fund this project that will create an overpass for our folks and just make the intersection safer. So I have the mayor here with me. She will make some remarks, and I have the city engineer for questions.
Welcome, Mayor. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee, and thank you, members of the House Capital Investment Committee, for hearing House File 1359. I'm Mayor Elizabeth Coutts, Mayor of the City of Burnsville. And in addition, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and also thank Representative Byrd for the great overview that she gave, but most specifically for her leadership and advocacy for the needs of Burnsville and the region. We're deeply grateful for her and her work in working together with us. The Highway 13, as she mentioned, and she painted a great picture of what that intersection is. So the Highway 13 and Nicollet Avenue intersection today is plagued with serious crashes, high levels of traffic congestion, including the transit vehicle accessing regional hubs, long waits for crossing local traffic, and stressful and dangerous crossing for pedestrians and bicyclists. With two dangerous crossings for a transit station, the Minnesota Valley Transit Authority and the Metro Transit Orange Line station, directly adjacent in close proximity to I-35W. This intersection is considered both extremely dangerous and one of the most important for transit access in a metropolitan region. The intersection of Highway 13 and Nicollet Avenue is a large at-grade footprint with both high speed and high traffic volumes. In Burnsville, we are experiencing an increasing and alarming number of serious injuries and fatal crashes. Since June of 2022 alone, three serious pedestrian crashes occurred at the intersection, two of which resulted in a pedestrian fatality. We are heartbroken as a community and concerned for our residents and non-residents alike who are using this very busy area. Between 2017 and 2021, there were 71 crashes reported at the project location, an average of one crash per every 25 days of the 5 years. I do want to note that we understand this hearing is informational and focused on the general obligation bonding part of the project. We are working with the Transportation Committee on the trunk highway portion of the project. MnDOT has advised us that the general obligation request in our bill should be lowered to $3.9 million rather than the $22.5 million the bill currently states. In closing, these improvements will serve auto users, pedestrians, and cyclists. The project is economically viable, environmentally sound, and socially responsible for the community by supporting the public transportation, active transportation, city and statewide climate resiliency goals, decreasing vehicle congestion, and introducing best stormwater management practices. Mr. Chair and the committee, with a grateful heart, we thank you for your consideration, and we stand ready for questions.
Thank you, Mayor. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Mayor. I just want to be clear: there's $22 million in the bill here. Did you give a different amount? What is being asked for?
Mayor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, it's always good to reconnect with you on all these many years. And as I mentioned, as we met with MnDOT, they asked us to lower to 3.9.
Representative Erdahl.
It's a better number for me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Closing comments, Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And me stumbling over my words, notwithstanding, this is an incredibly important project, not just for my community members, and we're a pretty great community, but for Representative Ryer's community and all the surrounding communities. Everybody passes through that intersection, literally everybody that comes to my district. In closing, I just want to mention that the city of Burnsville has worked hard to turn over every stone to get this state project funded. The city has secured $10 million in Met Council funding, $3 million in federal funding, $1.6 million from Dakota County, and the city of Burnsville has committed $1 million. We thank you so much for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Byrd. Next on the agenda, House File 2328, Representative Wolgamott. Welcome, Representative Wolgamott. Please proceed.
Well, good morning, Chair Lee and Lead Erdahl and my fellow members of the House Capital Investment Committee. I am so excited to be here this morning to present to you House File 2328, which is a bill to provide $5.5 million to renovate and develop a property to become the St. Cloud Youth and Family Center, which will be a site that will be open to all community members in central Minnesota for youth and adult education, sports, access to workforce and employment services, and additional community building opportunities focusing on entrepreneurship and health and wellness. Mr. Chair, I know we're on a tight schedule, so without further ado, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier, to provide further information to you about the St. Cloud Youth and Family Center.
Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Mohideen Muhammad. I'm the president of Islamic Center of St. Cloud, in St. Cloud. St. Cloud, we live in school district 742, about 10,000 students. 65% of that are minority. So we live in a district that are majority student of color. And to give you perspective, we also have the lowest performing school district in our area. Schools, elementary schools that are 85 or 95% minority are performing less than 8% proficiency level in terms of achievement gap. So we have also, the low employment accessible in our community. We also have dealing with a lot of youth that are at risk that are very at risk for, with school dropouts and going to prison. So with that, just introduction, we are developing this space to increase employment accessibility. We're working with the Credit Force Credit Solution in St. Cloud, partners with that. We're also partnering with School District 742 and Central Minnesota United Way to increase student achievement and address that disparity. We're also working with Stearns County to develop some of the health issues that are, in public health, especially when it comes to seniors. We have, a majority of the seniors who have no access to, exercise or a healthy diet, so we are partners with Stearns County to develop some of that. We're also working with Initiative Foundation to develop some economic development programs, projects, and they are part of this project. So this is a truly equity issues, and this project will address all of that disparity in St. Cloud area. And we hope that, with this investment, this community will thrive for this, after this investment. So thank you.
Thank you. So, questions, closing comments, Representative Wogelmuth.
Well, thank you again, Mr. Chair and Leader Erdahl and members for the opportunity to present this bill. This would be a huge victory for our youth, for our families, for our businesses in central Minnesota. With all my heart, I ask that we include House File 2328 in our ongoing capital investment bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Leader Erdahl. Thank you to my testifier for his leadership and hard work in putting this project together. I'm so proud to partner with you and get this project over the finish line. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wogelmuth. Next on the agenda, we have two bills for Representative Hansen. First up, House File 3163. Welcome, and please proceed. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3163 is an appropriation of $3.5 million to the PFA for a grant to the City of Cottage Grove. And I have with me the Mayor of Cottage Grove to talk a little bit about this facility relating to PFAS. As you know, PFAS, we've heard about in this committee and others, the East Metro has a lot of PFAS issues, and they continue in Cottage Grove. So with that, Mayor Bailey.
Welcome, Mayor. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair Lee. My name is Myron Bailey. I'm the mayor of Cottage Grove, and thank you to the committee for hearing my testimony today. The city of Cottage Grove has been at the epicenter of the PFAS contamination in Minnesota since 2006. Our residents waited years for our drinking water to be fully treated, and a comprehensive treatment plan provided through the 3M settlement. PFAS groundwater contamination was not the fault of the Cottage Grove residents, and these residents should not have to cover any costs related to drinking water treatment due to contamination. While the treatment plant and staff to operate them are paid by the 3M settlement, The support space for those staff and equipment are not covered. Through this bill, we're requesting $3.5 million for the design and construction of a water engineering and utility facility that will allow us to operate state-of-the-art water treatment to provide clean drinking water to our residents. The requested funding in this bill will cover 25% of the new operating facility that will provide office, storage, and garage space to support utility and engineering divisions. The current Public Works facility does not have the necessary space to house those divisions due to the added responsibilities and staff required to address PFAS contamination. The new facility will be specifically sized to handle the future growth of the PFAS treatment division, which are the key to the ongoing design, operations, and maintenance of the city's PFAS water treatment plant. The requested funds are proportionate to the increase in staffing required to address the water treatment. The new operating facility will be built adjacent to one of the new treatment plants. This will allow for efficient processes and workflow for the plant operators. Our city is focused to plan for tomorrow while delivering exceptional service today. As we face ongoing challenges related to PFAS contamination, we want to ensure our residents that we have taken the proper steps to ensure that their water is safe and they do not carry the financial burden for groundwater contamination. This is an important investment for the future growth of our city, but more importantly, an investment in clean drinking water for our residents, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you, Mayor. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mayor, what's the population of Cottage Grove?
Just over 40,000.
Representative Erdahl.
I think Representative Hansen knows where I'm going with this, so I'll just leave it there.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the per capita on this is pretty good.
So maybe this is a question for either Director Freeman or Mr. Johnson from the PFA or MPCA. So is this project eligible for any of the federal emerging contaminants funding? And can we get you up front to let us know? Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Johnson, Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'm not aware of that, Mr. Chair. I'll have to check on that. My understanding is that the amount of funding specifically coming in for contaminants of emerging concern and specifically for PFAS is would be more specifically for the treatment itself, and I believe this is more for capacity and other pieces of the puzzle, staffing capacity, the public works facility itself, not the drinking water facility itself, is my understanding. So, but I'll check back on that and get you more information, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Yeah. And then maybe to, is it Mr. Connolly, the public works director, can you just confirm if this is for the treatment or if this is more for the staffing and piece?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ryan Burfine, Public Works Director for the City of Cottage Grove. That is correct that this is more for the operations support facility. At full build-out of Cottage Grove, we had anticipated about 15 operations staff, and now we're looking at about 20. So about 25% of that staff would be focused on treatment.
Okay. Thank you. Closing comments, Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is actually a good example of the challenges dealing with forever chemicals. We have the settlement for 3M, but it's not enough. We have a facility that's not enough. We have a perpetual problem that is going to be there long after everybody in this room is gone. And how do we deal with it? So we can have a treatment facility, but we have to have people who deal with it. We have to have the people that work with it. And so here you have the public investment, whether it's from the federal or from the state, or from the local, the property taxpayers that are dealing with this chemical that did not exist 50 years ago. And we have to keep cleaning up the mess and accommodating it. So it's not good to be here to be asking for the money. We wish we didn't have this forever problem. But we're talking about drinking water. And we need this. So I'd ask for your support.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. Next on the agenda, House File 3225, Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for the city of Invergrove Heights, and this is water treatment, but it's for a different contaminant. This is relating to radium. Earlier I was in front of the committee with South St. Paul with radium in their drinking water. And so now we have Invergrove Heights, which is just south of South St. Paul. $2.4 million from the bond proceeds fund to PFA for a grant to IGH to construct and equip improvements for a water treatment plant in the city of Invergrove Heights. And I have with me staff from Invergrove Heights to talk about the details.
Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Senator Hanser. My name is Brian Conley. I'm the Public Works Director with the city of Invergrove Heights. I appreciate you having me here today to talk a little bit about our water treatment facility rehabilitation project. In late January of this year, the city of Invergrove Heights received notice of violation from the Minnesota Department of Health, indicating that the radium concentrations in the city's treated water exceeded the maximum contamination level set by the Environmental Protection Agency. While the levels were not considered an immediate danger to public health, it did trigger a public notification to our water customers and requires the city to submit a plan of action to bring the water treatment plant back into compliance. As the Public Works Director for the city, I have been at the forefront of this effort, working with our utility staff, the Department of Health, engineering consulting firms, and our local and state representatives to implement both short-term and long-term corrective action to address this issue. To understand why this issue has arisen, it is helpful to understand a brief history of the city's water system and to understand what radium is and why it's an element of concern in drinking water. The city of Invergrove Heights water system relies on groundwater that's pulled from the Jordan Aquifer. Groundwater is susceptible to certain types of varying concentrations of several naturally occurring elements, such as iron, manganese, and radium. While these elements are considered safe for human consumption in small doses, higher doses can create health concerns for certain individuals. Radium is one of these elements. Residual amounts of radium can also be found in air, soil, and surface water sources. In high doses and over long periods of time, the primary risk to humans due to radium exposure is the development of bone and other types of cancers. In the 1990s, due to water quality issues related to these elements, the city constructed a water treatment facility, which was brought online in 1998 and subsequently expanded to double its capacity in 2006. The plant was originally designed to provide disinfectant and treat primarily for the removal of iron and manganese. However, the chemical treatment process provided an ancillary benefit of removing residual amounts of radium from the groundwater as well, but it was not designed for that intent. The Department of Health has indicated that Invergrove's water treatment plant, along with roughly 30 other community water systems, operates as a first-generation radium removal plant in that it has the capabilities to remove radium, but radium removal is not the primary treatment operation. Invergrove Heights plant does not remove radium as efficiently as newer or rehabilitated facilities that have been designed for that intent, as has been the case in most newer plants constructed in the past 15 years. Starting in 2021, the city has worked with the Minnesota Department of Health to monitor radium levels in the city's water system, which started increasing in both the raw water and the treated water systems where we were testing for that chemical. The city implemented systematic adjustments to the treatment processes while also planning for a larger treatment plant filter replacement project to be constructed in 2024, with the primary goal of mitigating the increase in radium levels. Despite our best efforts, the radium levels have now exceeded that maximum contaminant level I alluded to at the start of my testimony. Since receipt of the radium violation notice, the city has undertaken additional steps to address radium removal in the short term while accelerating plans to rehabilitate our water treatment facility and chemical treatment systems. The focus of the preliminary design review, which is just getting underway, is to identify means to implement more efficient radium removal while also looking to treat for contaminants of emerging concerns, such as PFAS and PFOAs, and to be implemented in future treatment facility upgrades. While we don't have all the details yet, this project is moving along at a rapid pace. The preliminary design report is anticipated to be completed in July, with final design occurring by September and construction of the plant, the first phase of plant improvements, with the specific goal of addressing the radium issue to be completed by March of 2024. The total cost of the project will not be known until the preliminary engineering effort is completed in the coming months. The city has originally budgeted $2.5 million for the rehabilitation effort in 2024 as part of our capital improvement plan. However, based on our initial conversations with engineering consultants over the past 2 months, we now anticipate the total cost for this project to be at or above $5 million. As such, we are respectfully requesting $2.4 million in state bonding support for this project to assist in filling this funding gap. And with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this forward. Could you just talk about where it is in this project in terms of the PFA project priority list?
We have submitted for the PFA priority list this year. Those submittals, I believe, are due by May, so we will not hear back until after May whether or not this is a project that they would consider a priority.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up, are there any other pending funding sources or sources that you could be pursuing? Thank you.
We are pursuing other sources as available. Most of them would be local funding from the city's end. So we'd be deferring other projects in order to cover the funding gap should we not be approved for this or other types of sources that we're looking for. Thank you.
Calls in Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think it's important to note that this is not an ask for the whole project. It's a partial ask to help deal with this emerging threat that is increasing with radium, which we've heard the consequences of radium. I think this is going to be one of several around the state that come forward, and I'd ask for your support for this partial assistance for the city.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. So, members, next on the agenda, we're going to move over to the policy bills that we have today. Representative Erdahl.
I'll let you, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll let you finish and then I'll ask you something.
So we're just going to continue on with the policy agendas that we have, hearing these bills on an informational basis only. And then Representative Ryan will be taking over. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, now we've been dealing with bills today, financial bills. Now we're getting into some policy things. Are you intending that there be a policy capital investment bill, or would this be incorporated into the larger bill, or what is the thinking with this?
Well, Representative Erdahl, some of the bills that we have today have been heard and are traveling other bills, and depending on what happens with those budget bills, if we do have another capital investment bill, we may potentially put it in there if they're not traveling along when it's signed into law. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. Making sure that I understood that right, because there's a little rattling to my right here. Not that Representative Franzen would ever rattle to the right, but so you're saying that there is a possibility that this could be included into a larger bill, but also are some of these traveling separately in other omnibus bills possible?
Yeah, so Representative Erdahl, a few of these provisions are currently in some of the budget bills that are moving through the House and the Senate right now. And then depending on the results of those budget bills, if they're included in the final version or not, we may consider these as we consider a future bonding bill. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair, we can discuss that. Kind of like the ones that I like, maybe we could include the ones that I don't like, just let them go in other committees.
Sounds good, Representative Erdahl. And thank you, Representative Franzen, for bringing the donuts.
You can thank Erdahl for paying for them.
Thank you.
There's a lesson in patience this morning, let me tell you.
All right. Thank you, Chair Lee. We now get to the Chair Lee section of our show today with a number of bills coming up. So your first bill on the agenda is House File 1134. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your explanation. And I see that you have an amendment for reference coded H1134-A2, if you'd like to explain that first.
Thank you, Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to present House File 1134. The A2 amendment just changed the effective date to February 1st of 2024. And members, the bill before you today is a bill, we're seeing a lot of requests around county jails and law enforcement centers from bill introduction and when we go on tours. And so that's why I'm bringing this forward, to require the Commissioner of Corrections to study and make recommendations on the consolidation or merger of county jails and alternatives to incarcerations for persons experiencing mental health disorders. The commissioner must engage and solicit feedback from citizens who live in those communities served by the facilities that may be impacted by the recommendations of the consolidation or merger of jails. And also, for the study and recommendation, the commissioner must consult with county sheriffs, county and city attorneys that prosecute offenders, chief law enforcement officers, administrators of county jails facility, and district court administrators. And then the bill also require a report to the public safety and the capital investment committees. At a minimum, the report must have the following information around the daily average number of offenders incarcerated in each county jail facility, the actual cost of building a new jail facility, purchasing another facility, or repairing a current facility, and any specific recommendations for alternatives to incarceration for persons experiencing mental health disorders. And, you know, I think for me, Subdivision 3, when we're considering these projects, the evaluations, having the Department of Corrections help us understand if there are true need that, you know, we should really consider funding, or if they are coming to the state for state capital investment dollars. And so I'll leave it at that, Madam Chair, and I'm open to any questions.
Leader Dahl.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. And just so we're clear on the record here that this is a study to make recommendations. You're not mandating anything through this study that has to be done.
Chair Lee.
Chair, Representative Erdahl, that's correct. You know, I think for me, from my perspective, if local units of government are coming to ask for state dollars, I think that, you know, Department of Corrections, who's in charge of licensing these facilities, it will be good to know if they could weigh in on whether these are needed or not before we make any decisions whether to fund these facilities.
Leader Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Lee, we've been talking about this not just for jails but for fire halls over the years as well. I think it's important that there is some criteria for these types of projects. I think Representative Davids just dropped a bill for, I don't know, a dozen different fire halls, just to make a point that, if we start doing fire halls for some, then everyone should be eligible. Well, that the everyone eligibility becomes problematic, and that's why I do have a bill that I don't know if I've dropped it or what this. I have not, I guess, but on criteria for fire halls, I think we need to at some point resurrect those types of ideas and try to decide going forward what works best, because we do have a lot of fire halls, police stations that are in need of renovation or help, and developing criteria for how to do this and who to do it for, I think, is important.
Chair. Representative Erdahl, I really appreciate that, too. And, you know, the basis for, at least for this piece right here, is similar to, you know, what we're doing with, or I think back in the early 2000s with the public safety training centers, where we have that report from the Department of Public Safety. And I do agree, you know, regarding the fire halls, and I've been working with Representative Hewitt, you know, as a former member of the committee, to think about how could we structure a report on looking at, you know, fire halls and all of that local law enforcement too. And so I'm not opposed to, you know, what you suggested, and I think that we do need to have these conversations here in the Capital Investment Committee and hopefully in the committees with jurisdiction over those issues too.
Thank you.
Representative Koslowski.
Thank you, Chair Ryer, and Representative Chair Lee. I appreciate you bringing this study forward. I also appreciate in the language, on the page one it reads that it will be a study for impacts of mental health we know so often that it's co-occurring mental health and substance use disorders. So I'm glad to see that in later sections. My question is, in terms of who is consulted in the study, is there space to be able to fine-tune, to make sure that who is also co-designing are people impacted by incarceration, you know, getting at the recovery and treatment providers, historically excluded communities, tribal nations and others, especially as our communities are working really hard, have coordinated community crisis response. I think that's a really important element. So just curious if there's still space or is this the final language today?
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Kozlowski, for that question. You know, we are flexible. I think in my eyes, you know, right now with the proposal, this is one of the proposals I was alluding to earlier, that it is traveling and one of the committees, and I think there's still an opportunity for us to add on to that, and I welcome any feedback from members today on how could we improve the bill to make it more reflective of what we as a committee would like to see as this proposal move forward.
Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kozlowski actually stole what I was going to say. Great to see that particular provision on mental health, because as we moved away from institutionalization, we've either put a lot of these people on the street or in prison. So I just wanted to highlight that portion. We need to see that go forward.
Thank you.
Chair Lee, any closing comments?
No, thank you, Chair, and you know, really appreciate the conversation here, and members, I know that, you know, you have a lot of local requests, that some that pertains to the issue at hand, and, you know, we'll do our due diligence as we consider any proposal moving forward right now, but I will hope that we could get this so that in terms of, you know, future capital budget session, we could get some recommendations from the DLC as we move forward. So I really appreciate this conversation.
Next up is another bill for Chair Lee, House File 1133. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed. And again, I see you have an amendment coded H1133-DE1, if you'd like to explain that first.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. House File 1133, the DE1 amendment is to increase MMB's capacity to proactively raise awareness about the capital budget process and to provide technical assistance around the requirements associated with the capital budget process and receiving general fund or general obligation bonds funding for capital projects, including compliance requirement that must be met at the different stages for the development of the project. The focus of this appropriation is for helping out nonprofits, American Indian communities, and communities of color that have traditionally not participated and the state capital budget process. And I do want to note that in previous bill, we have this for, you know, small communities too. And even with this funding, even though it's not included in the language, having this additional support can help our small communities across the state so that they can learn about this and really, you know, have somebody from the public sector walking them through the process. It's not saying that MMB is not currently doing that, but this is to really increase support for that. And so we also have it in here that the appropriation may also be used to increase the agency's capacity to coordinate with other state agencies regarding the administration of grant agreements, programs, and technical assistance related to capital projects that are governed by the provisions of that Chapter 16A.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Lee. A question I have for you, as a new representative, I really tried to pride myself on, you know, going to my 11 communities and sharing opportunities that they have for bonding as well as other organizations. I'm just, you know, being on this committee, we see the requests are way higher than the amount of dollars that are available. And I'm just wondering, have you heard a lot of feedback from people saying, you know, why we need to implement this or consider this?
Chair
Lee.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Myers. As we, you know, go through the process and people are reaching out to us, hopefully they are reaching out to committee members too and not just me as chairs. People are asking, you know, nonprofits, local units of government, and even If I could recall correctly, back in 2021, my first biennium as chair, we actually had MMB come in and present about the capital budgeting process, because we have heard from local units of government about how they thought that, you know, the process that we have right now is not really helpful for them. I think, you know, one example why I got the support of the state gov chair to include this in the state gov finance bill was her community of Medicine Lake, you know, right between my community and yours. And so there is a need out there right now where, you know, people don't understand some of the requirements that we have for the capital budgeting process. And so I will hope that as we get this going forward, people will receive the information on the front end so that they can know and determine, make the determination on whether this is the right route for them to pursue state dollars for their projects or not.
Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a quick question and a follow-up is, if a community or nonprofit approaches, and maybe this is for MMB, approaches MMB and asks them what they need to do, MMB gives them guidance, correct?
So I will defer to MMB, but the intent here is for MMB to have the staff support so that if there is a potential project out there that would like to potentially seek state funding for capital projects, that they could in turn provide this information. And I would just say that, you know, we have a local one project that was considered in the bill that I believe we sent over to the Senate, that even after the passage of the bill, they were reaching out to myself and the committee administrators to figure out more information about what are some of the requirements. And so that's why we, you know, at that time defer them to reach out to some of the staff at MMB or some of the partners through the process. And so this will be to help give them more capacity to be able to assist small cities or nonprofits in reaching out and seeking state investment dollars.
Chair Lee, any closing comments? Oh, West, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just see this as really unnecessary because MMB does help people right now. And if people want to get bonding, they can ask MMB. Say they don't know what MMB is. Two, it's our responsibility as legislators. Since we're going to have to introduce a bill anyways, they should be coming to their state legislator saying, we need money for XYZ nonprofit. And it's our job to know how the bonding process works and do it. It's not so much trying to solicit more. And then to Representative Meyer's point, we already have more needs than we can handle. Why would we want to solicit even more just to say no to them in the end? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Lee.
You know, I think to that point, it is a really good point that, you know, we as members should know the process, but at the end of the day, a lot of our members don't. And so I think this is a learning experience for all of us so that, you know, we as members have a lot of different priorities that we're trying to push for, whether those are priorities for our local communities or on issues and subject areas that we really care about, that we are passionate around. And so I think that providing this support right now, in my understanding, and MMB can correct me if I'm wrong, I believe for this, for the capital budgeting piece, maybe one or two staff only. And so I think that providing that additional support is needed. And I think to the point around the number of projects that we have in place right now, I will hope that in reaching out to MMB to learn more about the process, that projects may look at and say, hey, maybe this is not the right path for us because of the different requirements that are in place. And so that's, you know, the reason why I'm bringing this forward for us to have discussion.
Representative West, anything further? Representative Koslowski.
Thank you, Chair Ryer and Chair Lee. I just want to say, again, thank you for bringing this forward. Honestly, if this, one of the only things that we did in bonding this year, although I want to pass lots of bonding, I think this is the most transformational, one of the most transformational things that we could do for our communities. And I appreciate your work and the conversations we had on this. You know, I come from local government, and coming into this work as a new legislator, and I'm grateful to have a partner who has been here time and time again. And yet we have communities, especially communities of color, our tribal nations, who don't have the same access to resources, the infrastructure, or also this social capital and the knowledge of the pathways of how to be able to access bonding, how to be able to access us as legislators, or even the
what can be a complicated process to get through bonding and to have the money for a lobbyist, right? So there's so many barriers in the way, especially for our Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities and others who really need us to step up in this way and provide these supports. And so I'm really proud to be able to look forward to supporting this and to working with our communities because everybody should have a crack at making sure that our communities thrive and not just those who know how to access and navigate the current systems. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Lee, for bringing this. I appreciate the comments from my colleague, Representative Kozlowski, also coming from local government. I understand firsthand the frustrations that we've experienced with the bonding process. That is that there's too much demand for too little supply. So I appreciate you, this process-oriented bill to help communities, you know, improve their proposals and result in better projects all around. So thank you.
Chair Lee, closing comments?
Thank you, Chair. I would hope that, you know, as this proposal move forward, we think about how could we have a make more of an impact and really have projects that are coming before us know the expectations on the front end so that we don't have to chase information or, you know, give them information that, you know, maybe they're not bonding or capital investment is not the right choice for them or path for them. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Next up, another bill for Chair Lee, House File 1135. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. House File 1135 is a proposal I believe we have heard a few times in this committee already. The first biennium when I served as a vice chair for Chair Murphy and last biennium. And this bill really looks at, you know, how could we, and I believe I do have a testifier too, Chair, and so I'll do my opening remarks and then have Dr. Graves come and present too. Really looking at how do weather impact the need for infrastructure, and I would just point to, you know, in 2019, I think the theme as I saw on the tours and for all of us as we move towards the tours this fall to really look at, you know, these different projects. So the theme in 2019 was flood hazard mitigation, and we heard from the city of Roseville today, and in 2021 was increased need, excuse me, for stormwater system improvement because of increased rainfall too. And so with those, I just thought that, you know, we do really need to understand how weather is impacting the need for infrastructure dollars from the state of Minnesota. And so the bill will appropriate funds to the University of Minnesota to conduct research on how projections of future weather trends may exacerbate conditions such as drought, elevated temperatures, and flooding that can be integrated into the design and evaluation of buildings constructed by the state of Minnesota and local units of government, and also look at how future weather trends may weaken the ability of natural systems to mitigate those conditions to the point where we have to invest in infrastructure to address those conditions. And so, Chair, with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Good morning, Dr. Graves. Once you're settled, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Great. Thank you, Chair Lee, Chair Ryer, and members of the committee. My name is Richard Graves. I'm the director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota, and I'm also a fellow in the Institute on the Environment. Unfortunately, Dr. Jessica Hellman could not be here today, so I'll be testifying in her place. House File 1135 provides funding to the Institute to research how projections of future weather trends impact capital construction in Minnesota. The university studied the impact of a changing climate on the design decisions for the built environment in a study for MPCA in 2018. As a standard of practice, the design community uses data from weather stations to inform energy and site design. The weather files from these stations are at best 15 years old, and at worst, 27 years or older. In the study, the data used data from a source called WeatherShift that compared current weather data to future projections for energy-efficient designs. And the study found that increased cooling and other warmer weather increased cooling systems in buildings were needed, because of warmer weather in the projections, and that warmer weather strategies should be integrated into building design. The research also identified the need for Minnesota-specific data and research, because a lot of the climate projection data is sort of generalized and not Minnesota specific, that we need to give better information for the design community. Fortunately, with funding from the legislature, the Minnesota Climate Action Partnership at the University of Minnesota is in the process of downscaling future weather data for use for agriculture, and we would intend to leverage that that data set that they're using for agriculture to be able to apply it for the built environment. So House File 1135 would extend that research to the built environment and allow a team of researchers working with the design community to develop recommendations for resilient designs to improve the building and site design of capital projects, and really all projects, not just capital projects in the end. The research will include the Minnesota-specific downscaled weather data to develop design processes for design guidelines for design teams to work with that data, not only for building design but also for site and water design. So thank you, Chair, and members of the committee for your time.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Lee. Is the intent of this to try to extend the life of buildings, you know, for the future? I'm just trying to figure out the overall reasoning for this.
Chair.
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Meyer. The intent is to look at how does extreme weather impact the need for infrastructure. And so, you know, if it's going to continually, you know, make us have requests for flood hazard mitigation or stormwater treatment, I think that it's good for us to know on the front end. And also, when we're building, I think to the piece around the building design, when we're building, funding infrastructure requests, are we looking at infrastructure that are going to be resilient for, that could, you know, withstand some of these extreme weather conditions that we're seeing too. And so I think that it's to inform us so that we can make sound decisions as a committee as we move forward.
Representative Myers.
Thank you. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see, you know, with the current information we have, how long buildings currently last versus what some of this information may, you know, improve that by a year, by 2 years. I don't know if that's the type of information we'll see if this goes through.
Dr. Graves.
I think that is a good question that, you know, quite frankly, we hadn't considered as part of the research. I could see an outcome of the research that, you know, as I testified, right now the data we're using is really old and outdated, and it's not really reflective of what the environment will be that these buildings need to operate within across their useful life. So I would anticipate that better data would let them, would improve the performance, and it may have a connection to the longevity of the buildings, but I don't know that at this time, and that would need to be a result of the research.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, and the reason I ask is, I think we'll all see here that, you know, if a building normally costs $10 million and all of a sudden it's $18 million and you're only getting 2 extra years out of it, got to look at that and see if that's going to be worth the cost.
Leader Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Lee, just in line with a question I asked earlier, just clarifying that this is for study and research and there are no mandates to do anything regarding that until a later date.
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Erdahl. Yes, that's correct. This is just to do research to inform us as we consider projects going forward. This is not mandating anything. Thank
you. Chair Lee, any closing comments?
No, thank you, Chair, and really hope that as members consider, you know, attending the tours that we're going to have and really think about, you know, some of the, I think, as we can see with the trends of the bill that I have, you know, resulting from the tours, how does, you know, some of the work that we do in other committees and, you know, this committee really go hands in hand with the capital request that we're going to see. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is another bill for Chair Lee, House File 2989. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed. And I understand you have an amendment for reference, coded H2989-DE3. Please explain your amendment.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Committee. I have the DE3 amendment for us to discuss since we are only hearing this bill informationally. And so the DE3 amendment creates a green infrastructure grant program under the MPCA that has a blank general fund appropriations in Section 5 of the amendment. And Section 2, 3, and 4 deals with some of the issues that I have raised with the Public Facilities Authority, the Department of Health, and the Pollution Control Agency regarding Minnesota's affordability criteria and the definition of disadvantaged communities for the Federal Clean Water State Revolving Fund and the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund. You know, as background members, as for those that are returning from the committee, last year we have a conversation around this too, and you know, the United States EPA in the memo for implementing the federal dollars from the Federal Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act encouraged states to, you know, look at and reevaluate their definitions and priorities for and defining what is a disadvantaged community and, you know, affordability criteria that is consistent with the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act and Clean Water Act. And, you know, throughout the memo, the EPA identified that disadvantaged communities to include those with environmental justice concerns that often include low income and communities of color. So according to the EPA, disadvantaged communities exist in every state, tribe, and territory and encompass urban, suburban, and rural areas across America. Disadvantaged communities experience or are at risk of experiencing disproportionately high exposure to pollution. So after reviewing Minnesota's definition of affordability and disadvantaged community, I believe that our current definition using average residential drinking water costs and the median household income of the project service area fails to capture other hardship that communities, you know, in urban, suburban, rural, big and small cities face in assessing resources. Using median household income does not capture household in poverty, especially communities with wide income distribution and those whose income falls well below the community average and for whom water rates constitute a greater portion of their income. And so I want to ensure that federal and state funding gets to communities that experiences financial hardships, environmental exposure, and health burdens regardless of where they're at in the state of Minnesota. And so Section 2, 3, and 4, or 5 is language that was provided to me from the Public Facilities Authority, MDH, and MPCA. And so now I would like to turn it over to the PFA to come and talk about that. And I do want to note that I really appreciate the collaborative effort that we have had with the agencies to get to this far. I think that there's still more work to do. And so that's why I'm bringing this bill forward today. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Director Freeman. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. I'm here to speak specifically to Sections 2 and 3, which refer to the PFA, the Clean Water Revolving Fund, and 4 and 5, referring to the Drinking Water Revolving Fund. And as I've testified to this committee before, these programs are fundamentally revolving loan funds, providing low-interest loans that are the state's largest source of funding assistance to cities across the state for water infrastructure projects. The PFA is responsible for maintaining the strength and stability of those revolving funds to provide long-term sustainable funding for Minnesota cities of all sizes. The revolving funds are supported by annual federal capitalization grants and state match funds. Federal law allows a portion of those federal funds to be used as principal forgiveness grants essentially to for specific purposes to address affordability, green infrastructure, as well as disadvantaged community needs. We did have significant concerns with the original bill language, and I want to thank Chair Lee for good dialogue to talk through those concerns, and we offered some alternative suggested language to address those concerns while maintaining the stability of the existing funding framework. These changes add additional uses, additional eligible project categories for the Federal Principal Forgiveness Funds, do not replace or change the existing criteria, but add additional uses for target areas and specific types of projects. So appreciate the cooperation to develop this language.
Thank you, Director. Will Mr. Peterson also be testifying? I'm sorry? Mr. Freeman, would you like to stay up there, and then when we get to questions? Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bradley Peterson, here today on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. When we initially signed up to testify, we did have significant concerns about the language in the underlying bill that changed the affordability criteria. As I'm sure you've gleaned from Mr. Freeman's comments, these are very important programs that fund programs, projects across the state. It's a very complicated system. I'm happy to say that with the language in the DE3 amendment, that a lot of our concerns have been allayed. I think we're still evaluating the impact of some of these items, but this language certainly is a giant step in the right direction from our perspective, and we appreciate the work of Chair Lee and Mr. Freeman in putting this together.
Lee Durdall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and you know, I agree. I appreciate the, I believe, improvements made in this through the amendment. I'm glad that, you know, it's being laid over. I mean, there is still some time if additional concerns need to be addressed. I guess I would like to ask Director Freeman, do you still have concerns with this? I mean, have your concerns been addressed properly in terms of being able to move forward in an expeditious manner with this legislation?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, I would not call them concerns, but there are issues we still need to work through. This does introduce, as you'll see, a definition of a supplemental demographic index. It ties back to EPA's environmental justice screening tool to identify distressed areas within by census block and census data within cities throughout the state. I think we want to have some time and work with our partners at Pollution Control Agency and Health Department to better understand how that's going to affect all of the projects. But our main concern that we did not want to replace or disrupt the existing funding framework, this amendment does address that concern. It keeps the existing framework as is and adds to it for some additional purposes, and we think that's a good change.
Lee Durdall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's hopeful, promising to us. I mean, my concern that I have for this and for, you know, all of these bills, well, not all of them, but those that deal with PFA, is that they do not place obstacles in the way of denying or delaying projects across the state, but for me, you know, particularly in greater Minnesota. I have concerns because the demographics of Greater Minnesota are different from Hennepin County and Ramsey County and some other areas. So I share that concern. Hopefully that demographic index issue can be worked out because, again, my main concern is that those places throughout Minnesota that need the help that PFA provides will be able to get that help in an expeditious way.
Representative Myers.
Thanks, Chair Ryer. Chair Lee, I'm going to piggyback a little bit off what Lead Erdahl said. I'm very unfamiliar with this. First time I saw it, that screening and mapping tool. I don't know if there's somebody up there who would be able to give a little bit more detail and maybe after committee if there was some additional detail that could be provided to the committee members here to kind of better understand, you know, what that encompasses, but a little information may be helpful for me.
So the tool was introduced to me by the Department of Health and the PFA, and so maybe they could talk a little bit more about that.
Director Freeman.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, so when the, as part of the rollout of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, the new or additional funding, EPA did bring out guidance that included they've done extensive work to develop this nationwide mapping tool based on census data, and there's many different metrics that you can look at and identify through mapping. Chose and EPA has suggested this supplemental demographic index kind of ties together, as you'll see in the bill, income data, unemployment, education levels, and things like that. And it then you can see on the map, and I think it's available online. Environmental Protection Agency, Environmental Justice Screening and Mapping Tool, I think you can find it. As far as sort of how we're going to, the existing projects on the list and which projects fall into those areas, I think that's where we want to do some more work so we can provide better information on how this will work. But we think it's an appropriate tool to use. It's something that EPA recommends, and we think it's a workable way to address these issues.
Director Freeman, if you could please follow up with us with information about that we can share with the committee, that would be helpful.
Yes.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair Ryer. Yeah, that would be great if you could just, if there's supplemental information. The final question I had is, I just saw that there's a blank appropriation, and so my question would be, Chair Lee, is there any sort of range you can, and I'm not holding you to it, but I'm just trying to look if there's some sort of range, and not a dollar to 10 million, but I just didn't know if there was some sort of information you could provide on that.
Chair. So thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Myers, I'm sorry. With regards to the Green Infrastructure Program, we don't really have a range, but I would say that at least, you know, with the governor's request for stormwater, I believe infrastructure was around $20 million or so. And so I think that, you know, for green infrastructure, it will be around that ballpark figure.
Thank you.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lee. So I'm on the Environmental Protection Agency's little app here. And maybe you could actually show us how to use the app, because when I check St. Paul and I even checked Alexandria, I get this area is too small or sparsely populated, or this data is not available in the national data set, cannot generate an EJ screen chart or report. So maybe I'm not using it correctly, but I mean, I'm pretty good at putting in zip codes and getting information, but that's the information I'm getting when I look that up. So what am I?
Director Freeman.
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, there is like a whole list of sort of metrics that you can choose, and I'm not sure quite what you're, how you're selecting that, but I mean, it's definitely a tool that's somewhat new to us as well. We've been looking at it and talking with other states, and I think we have more to learn. So we'll definitely do some more work on, especially looking at the projects that are on the current project priority list and how those projects would be affected by this.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Freeman, so when I'm on the Justice Screening and Mapping Tool and launched the EJ Screen Tool. It says Explore EPA's Environmental Justice Screening and Mapping Tool. I click the link, and so I click OK to launch the tool. Now, if it stays within the latitude and longitudinal location, and I hit Show Report, then the report comes. There's all kinds of variables, particulate matter, ozone, things that you already know that are on that map. But when I go to the individual zip code, because I'm not going to know what the longitudinal latitude I'm looking at for Alexandria at this particular time, that's when I'm given this information. So do you have to know the latitude and longitude, or do you have to actually be in that location for it to work correctly?
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, I think you, I haven't tried to look by zip code. I think there's a way to, it's really census tract and census block, which are smaller pieces. So I'm not familiar enough with it at this point yet to tell you exactly how to make it work, but we will definitely do more work on that.
Thank you, Director Freeman. Representative Franzen, we have it up over here on a laptop, and I wonder if it's not optimized for mobile because it is searching by zip code, and the usability experience might be better. But appreciate the feedback because user experience and design is key to having tools be useful to users. Thank you.
And Chair, maybe to that point, you know, it might be interesting if members are interested for us maybe to get together with the MPCA and the PFA to take a look at this tool, or maybe we reach out to the EPA themselves and see if they could provide us a tutorial on how to use this tool.
That'd be great. That's what I'm asking for. Thank you.
Chair Lee, closing statements.
Thank you, Chair. Really appreciate the conversation that we have here, and I think to Representative Erdahl's point around making sure that we're not going to disrupt the systems and understand the demographics of, you know, greater Minnesota. I would just want to point out that the demographics here in the Seven County metro area are not the same, too, even within counties and even within cities. And I would just speak, you know, plainly to my district, where if you compare the city of Minneapolis, you know, North Minneapolis, where I represent, to other parts of the Minneapolis, there's great disparities. And so I think, you know, the intent of what I'm trying to get at is that regardless of where you live in the state of Minnesota, big or small cities, urban, rural, or suburban, that if you need help, the state of Minnesota and the federal money that are coming to the state actually get to you and your communities. And so really appreciate the conversation that we have here, and there's more work to do, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lee. We're now on to Chair Lee's final bill, House File 1132. Director Freeman and Mr. Peterson, I see that you're both testifying on this bill again, so if you'd just like to stay. And I understand that you have an amendment for this bill, the H1132-DE1. Please explain your amendment and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. And this bill and this amendment will be a good segue next to your bill, Chair, House File 749. And so the DE1 amendment is suggested language that I have received from MMB after they have consulted with various state agencies regarding the implementation of the underlying bill in 1132. And I believe that this language still gets to what I was trying to get at with regards to making sure that projects that are supposed to, you know, abide by the guidelines of the state sustainability guidelines actually do so. And so Section 1 of the bill talks about the Sustainable Building Guidelines Certification. The bill specifies that the recipient of an appropriation, you know, I think this gets to one of the points that was
recommended from the OLA report when they look at this program is to make sure that we know the different roles and responsibility. And so this is really putting the work on the project owner to make sure that they go through a form that will be created from the Department of Administration to certify that they understand if their project have to abide by the guidelines or not. And then we also have it in here with the grant agreement that if a project does not comply with the subdivision, that the grantee agency was able to claw back the money from the project for failing to meet some of the requirements of the state sustainability guidelines. And so just making sure that everyone know by certifying a form that will be created from MNB that the responsibility is on the project owner. And then also this allows the flexibility for the agencies to not withhold fund, but to stop funds until there is certification that says that, you know, they can move forward because they have complied with the guidelines. And with that, I'll turn it over for any questions.
Director Freeman, were you planning to testify?
Madam Chair, on this bill, I would just, and again, thank you, Chair Lee, for these changes to our concern all along has been that there are hundreds of water and wastewater projects moving through the planning and design process at any one time. These are complicated. The buildings that for water and wastewater treatment, the energy usage is not in the normal building itself. It's in the equipment and the treatment processes that go on with inside the building. There are requirements, special requirements for air exchange, ventilation, lighting. These are really technical systems that and there is an extensive review process within the Pollution Control Agency and the Health Department by their engineers that include cost and effectiveness reviews and energy efficiency reviews. So they are really a different type of building from most of the buildings that would be funded through state capital funding. And there needs to be the ability to treat them in somewhat of a different way, recognizing that extensive review process that's already happening within Pollution Control Agency and Health Department. So we've just seen this language, I think, recently. I'll want to talk with our partners at PCA and Health to, you know, kind of work through this and see it. But I think the changes are certainly a good step.
Thank you, Director Freeman. And could you please identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Jeff Freeman, Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority.
And Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, my name is Bradley Peterson with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I think I would just echo what Director Freeman said. You know, this is new language to us. We did have significant concerns with the underlying bill. This is a step in the right direction again. But I think that, you know, as Director Freeman stated, these are unique facilities that have a very important purpose in terms of maintaining high water quality and health within a community and those downstream. And so as these projects go through the process, they are rigorously evaluated by the PFA, MDH, et cetera. And so, you know, we just want to make sure that we're not delaying these projects, that we're adding costs to these projects that are unnecessary. And I can also say that, you know, within the wastewater community itself, there's a lot of discussion about how to create efficiencies when it comes around energy use and such. There's a lot of innovation and research going on, and so it is top of mind for those professionals as well.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I see the legislative auditor here. I'm just wondering if she could maybe give a little bit of context relating to the audit report and on the clarity side of clarifying who is responsible and what the recommendation was from the legislative auditor when they looked at this.
Uh, Please proceed. Director, please proceed. Thank you for being here. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall, Legislative Auditor. Thank you, Representative Hansen, for calling me up, and thanks, Chair Lee, for the bill. As you all know, we had a number of recommendations related to the Sustainable Building Guidelines, and some of the key issues that we identified were that accountability for identifying who is responsible for the for complying with the guidelines and who is ensuring compliance were not clear. And so I believe that this bill, which of course I left over at my chair, is a good first step towards clarifying some of those roles.
Leader Dahl.
Oh, okay.
Representative Myers.
Thanks, Chair Ryer. Chair Lee, I see in here that there's a 60-day requirement that they have to pay back. And, you know, we heard some testimony today talking about how some of this stuff can be fairly complicated. And I'm wondering if, you know, somebody that had taken on this project heard back they weren't in compliance, if you feel like 60 days is enough time for them to either, I guess, dispute that, try to remedy that, if there's some flexibility to the 60 days or how the 60 days kind of came up.
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Myers, for the question. I will defer to either admin or MMB since this was just the language from them on the timing of the 60 days.
Okay. Looks like we have it started. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Jennifer Hassimer, Assistant Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. So in regards to the 60-day timeline that's in the Delete All amendment before the committee today, there will be provisions in the grant agreements that the local grantees will need to execute that does allow for cure periods. So as long as that there is some effort towards meeting the sustainability guidelines, it's not a hard and fast 60 days. But once the cure period will have expired under the grant agreement, then this requirement will become effective.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair Ryer. And I appreciate that. You know, it's important. Again, I'm just looking at my own city. I've got a couple cities that have, you know, 1,500, 2,500, you know, 4,000. And sometimes, you know, they're not as, they're not staffed very well. So, you know, making sure that we have that time frame, cure period, if there is a dispute of some sort that it can be handled, because I can imagine some of these amounts can be rather large. And we just want to make sure that we're supporting the cities and working together with them.
Commissioner? Representative Lee? Chair Lee, any comments? Leader Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that, you know, some attempts are being made to make this better. This was a piece of legislation that we had some major problems with last year. You know, we still, you know, I think are unclear as to some of these provisions. As Director Freeman, he can correct me if I'm not portraying this correctly, but it seemed that he also appreciates the changes, but a little more study needs to be made to determine the impact. The particular one that I have, you know, the PFA has the expertise to certify these projects. They understand in depth what's going on. The role of the University of Minnesota in this, I think, is still unclear. Are they supplanting the role of the PFA in any way in the certification? Chair Lee, what is the role of university in this?
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Erdahl. You know, the University of Minnesota, you know, the center, and I will have Dr. Graves come and talk about this himself, you know, regarding the PFA piece. The MPCA have ran a pilot project, my understanding, with the center to do a pilot program looking at some of these water treatment facilities. And so I will turn it over to Dr. Graves to answer their role in this piece.
Dr. Graves, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Richard Graves, Director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research. I agree it's not within our expertise to know the technical requirements of these facilities. We have done some work over the last 3 years working with the experts at MPCA on if you took some of the processes to benchmark energy usage in these facilities and consider strategies to save energy, what could you do? However, I mean, one of the things that we found is there are emerging federal standards for doing this work that really you need to leverage that expertise. So our recommendation, I think, is in line with Director Freeman's testimony that you know really need to leverage that expertise, use those standards for energy efficiency that are coming from federal guidelines and also within wastewater treatment, and the work that we do should just be adding to that general direction, but not supplanting it in any way because it's outside of our expertise.
Chair Lee.
So I think to that point, you know, that's really that point. And, you know, we have an opportunity now to either through the Capital Investment Committee, through Chair Hansen's Environment Committee, or through Chair Acom's Climate Committee that, you know, maybe we do need to invest in getting the professional expertise that can deal with that so that we can make this a robust program for any project that is getting state capital dollars.
Leader Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, again, I believe, you know, the PFA has, you know, the very strong capacity of handling this. They've been doing it for a long time. So just to be clear, Mr. Graves, do you view your intent as, well, maybe you can tell me what your intent is. Is it to advise? Do you anticipate having, for example, you know, veto power over certification? What more specifically is your role?
Director Graves.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would see our role as advising a process driven by MPCA and the wastewater treatment industry, but not certifying, you know, reviewing whatsoever. That's been the role in the work to date, and I think that's where there's some value. But again, it's not within our expertise to review or approve these projects.
Leader Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Graves. That gives me, I think, some comfort in this. You know, the points that have been made, I've made them, testifiers have made them. You know, we are concerned about increasing expense and time and getting these projects out. And I don't want to see roadblocks placed on a system that I think has been working pretty well. One final question. I think that, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this is in Representative Sahn's omnibus bill that's coming up Tuesday, I think. Does that bill or will that bill have this amendment?
Chair Lee.
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Chair Ryer and Representative Erdahl. No, this is not included in the economic development bill.
Leader Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you say that that's not in the omnibus bill?
Chair Lee.
Or that it's not been amended?
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Chair Wright. Thank you, Representative Erdahl. It's not included and will not be included.
Okay. That's it. Well, one final.
Leader Erdahl.
Thank you. So if it does pop up in an omnibus bill somewhere and did not have this amendment on it, would you be amending it then?
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. I think, you know, Representative Erdahl, to the point about where this will be, if we do have a capital investment bill, this will likely be included in our capital investment bill.
Chair Lee, closing comments.
Thank you, Chair Ryer, and I think to the, some of the remarks that Representative Erdahl was making around the PFA having the expertise, I would like to clarify, at least it's been communicated to me, that's not the PFA that have the expertise, but the MPCA and the Department of Health who have the capacity, who have the engineers who know and understand this process. And so it's, you know, through working with the agencies and working with Dr. Graves to really, you know, look at these standards. And, you know, if we want to improve these standards for our water treatment facilities, I think we have the ability to do so. And so that's something that, you know, I as chair have an interest in. And so we're going to continue to look at that. And, you know, I think to the comment about, well, the system is working well, you know, Representative Erdahl, we saw a report from the OLA saying that the system is not working. And so I think this is where, you know, we may have differing opinion. And so that's why we're bringing this proposal forward and the proposal that Representative Ryan will be presenting next. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. The last bill today is my bill, House File 749. So I will switch places with Chair Lee and turn the gavel back over to him.
Welcome, Representative Ryer. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee. And committee members, House File 749 provides a comprehensive revision of the approach used to administer the state's sustainable building guidelines based on recommendations from the recent Office of the Legislative Auditor's Evaluation Report on Sustainable Infrastructure. The bill identifies, clarifies accountability, naming the Department of Administration as the lead agency responsible for guideline administration and oversight. Further, it directs the department to contract with the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota to administer the guidelines. Throughout, the Commissioner of Administration is to consult with the Commissioner of Commerce as well as other stakeholders. The bill also updates the guidelines as required by statute, adding climate change resilience guidelines that help buildings adapt to and accommodate both acute events and chronic trends, including but not limited to changes in temperature and precipitation level. It clarifies which projects the guidelines apply to, specifying that they must be at least 10,000 square feet and include a heating or cooling system. It spells out administrative requirements, including providing training and support to project team members. It sets expectations for monitoring compliance, gathering data, setting goals, and evaluating outcomes. It requires a process to be defined to review and approve waivers to the guidelines, and it requires an annual report to the legislature by February 1st of each year. Across the framework, it's important to note that the ultimate accountability lies with the project owner, with oversight by CSBR on behalf of the Department of Administration. Our goal is to have a program that supports project owners and teams, holds projects accountable, and for which we know compliance and outcomes. I'll close with my thanks to the Office of the Legislative Auditor, MMB, the Department of Administration, the Department of Commerce, for your collaboration on moving from the evaluation report to a defined path forward. I look forward to resolving the last details. Thanks too to Professor Richard Graves from the Center of Sustainable Building Research at the U of M, who will now talk more about the climate resilience guidelines and the center's proposed role as outlined in this bill.
Before we turn it over to Dr. Graves, members, I do want to note that Representative Ryer is referencing the 749DE5 amendment. Dr. Graves, please identify yourself and proceed.
Chair Lee, Representative Ryer, members of the committee, my name is Richard Graves. I'm the director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota, and we provide technical assistance to the Departments of Administration and Commerce for the Sustainable Building Guidelines and work with project teams to support their work. House File 749, as modified, responds to the report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor in six areas: agency responsibility, roles and responsibilities, project applicability and notification, goals and objectives, and training and resources. Representative Ryer has outlined the general approach in the bill, so I will highlight a few other items. Agency responsibility. Subdivision 5 outlines that the Department of Administration, in consultation with the Department of Commerce, is primarily responsible for the administration and oversight of the sustainability guidelines. In terms of roles, before I get to the role of the Center for Sustainable Building Research, as Representative Ryer stated, it's essential to keep in mind that ultimately the owner of a capital construction project is responsible for the compliance of the project with not only the sustainability guidelines, but wage rates and other requirements of the funds. And when I say owner, that is the entity contracting with the design team, contractors, and other groups to complete the project. The role of the Center for Sustainable Building Research is to provide training, develop compliance procedures, administer a tracking system, collect project data, maintain and update goals, and provide technical assistance to support the owners of capital construction projects and their design teams. In terms of goals and objectives, the center has developed in the past and the current guidelines a set of sustainability goals that we can build upon going forward, and track that data with data supplied by the projects for compliance to the center. Key sustainability performance metrics will be tracked in the following goal areas: energy and carbon, water usage, waste reduction, health, materials, site design, and with the language in this bill, resilience. In terms of resources, the Minnesota Sustainable Building Guidelines have been flat funded since their creation over 20 years ago. This has reduced the number of resources for project support, training, research, and compliance tracking annually. And the center looks forward to providing additional information to the bill authors and departments to not only update that funding, but increase the capacity to support the 2023 capital budget and budgets in the future. The center staff and the B3 team look forward to working with the authors in the departments to continue to refine the language in the bill as needed and support the successful integration of sustainability and resilience for capital projects in Minnesota. Thank you, Chair, Representative Ryer, members of the committee, the departments, and the Office of the Legislative Auditor for your role in this process and support in this process. And I thank you for your time, and I'm here to answer questions.
Thank you, Dr. Grace.
Is it question time?
Question, yeah. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ryer, so I'm reading on the 9-page fiscal note here. On page 5, it says there are local fiscal impact, local projects receiving bond or general fund appropriations may be impacted. Could you explain to us what that impact looks like?
Representative Ryer.
So thank you, Chair Lee. Thank you, Representative Franzen. To me, that would imply that the local projects may have someone who is working on the paperwork, but I would have to maybe turn to fiscal staff.
Representative Ryer, I'll have Wayne Wazlowski from the Department of Administration, who prepared the fiscal note, come and answer the question.
Thank you.
Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Wayne Wazlowski. I'm Assistant Commissioner at Department of Administration, and that is, Representative Ryer was correct. Essentially, there's some additional reporting and engagement requirements, so just wanted to flag that there's a potential administrative time that would be involved for local units of government in making sure they're in compliance with state law related to the sustainability guidelines.
Representative Franzen.
All right, Mr. Chair, just to let you know, I do have a few questions, okay?
That's fine.
All right, thank you. So, Representative Ryer, what about projects before this bill? Let's just say House File 749 gets passed into law.
So currently I'm thinking about my sweet district in the city of Alexandria, the city that is easy to get to and hard to leave. Okay, so we have that nice little bonding project with the third, with the Runestone Community Center. And lo and behold, after we get this, we worked very hard. Actually, it's Representative Paul Anderson's bill. I had the parking lot at the time, so he was the chief author. I have now the entire thing. Okay, so I just had the parking lot previous to when the bill was passed. But I'm thinking of this sweet little project. And lo and behold, they found out they had to, like, put some solar panels on the roof, which doesn't exactly work out. It increased the cost by a couple of million dollars here. Would this project be, would that project be impacted? So could my sweet little city of Alexandria continue on with the project without adding the solar panels, because based on the Sustainable Building Guideline OLA report, basically said there's really no way to determine if the project is meeting its goals, if it's been done. So does that make sense? Did I? Okay.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Franzen. Having spent many happy hockey tournaments in Alexandria, I wouldn't want anything to harm your sweet little project. Therefore, I would point you to the subdivision three lines 3.11 down through 3.21, that it does not apply to buildings that have or projects that have received funding after January 1st, 2023, or that have already completed design.
Okay.
Representative Franzen.
Okay, great. So we'll talk offline on that issue then, okay? And then, Mr. Chair, sorry, I just cut in front of you there. So if this bill were to pass, House File 749, should local units of government be including the increased costs in their bonding requests?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Franzen. I would hazard to say, and the commissioner can correct me, that looking at what we have mapped out so far, we are not mapping out an onerous process. We're not adding a great deal to what they're supposed to already be doing. We're adding a step or maybe a couple of steps that clarify it and actually make it easier for them. So I'm personally not anticipating that they would need to staff up a department to manage these.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, again, Wayne Wasloski with Department of Administration. I would fully agree with the statement that Representative Ryer made. Again, this is intended to make sure that folks are doing what they're already supposed to be doing under state law, which is to comply with the guidelines, which has been a requirement for a number of years.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, yeah, if I recall correctly, this, I remember I was, like, very young when this was passed, like 20 years ago, the B3, right, 22 years ago, somewhere in there. I was super young, as we all were at that time. Well, you were younger. and it was just recently, because the city of Alexandria was not aware when we worked on the bonding project that they would be having to include solar panels at that time. So we had talked about this earlier. So had they known, they probably would have wanted to include those, that solar panel cost in that project, correct? Which is, so it increased. So what I'm saying is that project cost increased. But what I'm thinking now, what I'm hearing maybe, is that they don't have to put those solar panels on until this, since it was before this bill.
Representative Ryer.
Chair Lee, thank you, Representative Franzen. You may or may not be speaking of solar panels symbolically as a change in project scope, but that's what I'm hearing. My response about adding costs was about the administration of the project and what would happen with people, say, in the local government. If, in fact, the design requirements as the project worked through them changed the design scope, yes, they would want to scope out and budget for all of the work they were actually going to do.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would just say if they had started their project, part of what the audit report identified is that some projects weren't aware early on in the design process that they were going to be, if they were going to get state bond funds, that they would be required to meet those sustainability guidelines. So part of the what we're looking to address here is making sure that everyone's fully aware when they start their design that whether or not the B3 guidelines are applicable. And what we're specifically now also trying to identify is that if a project currently hasn't been following they've done design work, for example, with their own funding separate from construction funds, and they're now asking for state funds. They've already completed the design, and now they're asking for state assistance with construction. The intent was to make that so they didn't have to redesign their project for this. We're trying to deal with this specific window at point in time. So that's what we're trying to solve. But if they, let's say, for example, this local project had already received state bond funds to do that design work, they were already obligated under state law to meet the guidelines. So in that case, you know, that obligation would remain to meet the guidelines.
Dr. Graves.
Yep, so Richard Graves, Center for Sustainable Building Research. I would encourage that project team to reach out to us at the center, and we can kind of dig into the previous requirements for energy efficiency. There isn't a direct requirement. Well, there's one requirement for 2% energy from solar in statute, but I would encourage the project team to meet with us so we can dig into the details, because what we often find is there's often kind of misunderstanding of some of the requirements, and the project teams will start driving up the cost of their projects. And if they meet with us, work those through, we can kind of fine tune them before it goes too far.
Representative Ryan? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, the question for you is the bill that we passed off the House floor, 669, 670. Will this impact that in any way?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Lead Erdahl. If this were put in place, I believe the effective date is
July 1st, 2023.
Okay, yep. So it would be as of the effective date. So, yes, it could.
Representative Erdahl.
I think that does it. The bonds will be issued after the date, so this would apply.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. We'll work with Representative Ryer and the agencies to clear that up for all members as we move forward, if this is going to be included in any proposal. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Thank you, Lead Erdahl. I just want to assert and reinforce that the last thing we want to do is have a lot of projects, good projects, have issues and gotchas. So we'll work that through. Thank you.
Real quickly before you, Representative Erdahl, it is my hope that the Senate take up that bill so that we can get it passed. If not, then I think that we're starting from scratch again. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the members here to think about, it's already difficult enough to pass a bonding bill that adding increased mandates and costs to local units of government is going to make it even harder than it is now to pass a bonding bill. So just something that I want on the record.
Thank you. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Thank you, Representative Franz. And to me, when I look at something like this and I look at the steps that are in place and I look at the findings of the audit report, there's a lot of confusion on the part of project owners. They aren't sure what they should be doing. As you know, from my background, I know that when you can clarify a process, simplify a process, really document it, what we will actually be doing, my goal is that it will make it easier rather than harder, and I invite you to be part of the conversations.
Representative Francine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Ryer. One of the suggestions, I believe, in the OLA report, too, is just to scrap the program altogether, which, in my opinion, would be probably the best. That's what I would hope to achieve. Thank you.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess mine's more a general comment because I think that was kind of almost a general comment over there too. I just think all these bills that we're hearing today are just really great opportunities. I mean, I look at it, having served on this committee for a while, I just think they're you know, we're just really being thoughtful. And I go back to like the flat roof on buildings, but you we know that's a problem. And so we're leaning into that and saying, hey, if you're going to build something in this state, we're going to do it differently. And I think that's what all these bills that we're just kind of hearing here are, you know, sustainable buildings make a lot of sense. Weatherproofing, you know, with the world changing and building things that respond to that, I think it makes a lot of sense. Energy use, yeah, why not lean into that and make better buildings all across the board? Helping people that weren't able to get the money, access to it, helping in that way. All these bills, I think, are really great. And I really, hats off to you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Ryer for bringing these forward. I'm glad we're thinking of building better things in Minnesota. It's exciting for all of us, I think.
Any additional members' questions or comments before the chair and then have the author close? All right, seeing none, I would just like to say thank you, Representative Ryer, for bringing this forward, and to the Office of the Legislative Auditor for taking a look at this program, providing the recommendations, and yourself for taking the lead on addressing some of the recommendations, some of the findings. And just my thoughts on the piece around costs. If we make this known on the front end, and so this bill, working in conjunction with 1132 that we heard, the DE1 amendment, will make it known on the front end to projects so that when they're coming before us, they could have all the costs in front so that we, as we consider putting a budget bill together, will know that the project and the costs in front of us have incorporated, some of these sustainability guidelines in the first place. And so I just really want to say thank you for bringing this forward. And closing comments, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Thank you, members. To me, this is a really important bill. It's an important piece of doing capital investment well. We know that we live in a time when climate change is driving changes in temperature and precipitation. We're seeing the effects and stresses on our built structures. And this gives us a chance to be looking ahead so that as we move forward, we are adapting and being prepared for what could be coming. So I think it's really important work, and to me then the contribution of the legislative auditor gives us the chance to say, how do we do this well? Because if we're going to do it, and I think we must, we want to do it well. And I am especially appreciative of all who participated, because how often do you actually see a report that is issued in February have legislation that addresses the recommendation just a number of weeks later? So I appreciate everybody stepping up and being engaged and working through pain points, working through parts that were harder to implement or easier to implement, and coming up in cases with some really elegant solutions. So I'm looking forward to seeing this move forward. It is being carried in the climate and energy bill. And again, thank you for the conversation, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Representative Kozlowski, can I have a motion to approve the minutes for April 3rd?
Yes, we have a motion.
Representative Kozlowski, move approval of the minutes for April 3rd. Any discussions? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Members, I just want to say thank you. And this concludes the 25th meeting of the House Capital Investment Committee. We have covered a lot of projects since our first hearing that we had 3 months ago. And I just want to say thank you to all members and to Vice Chair Ryer for her assistance in this process, Lead Erdahl, you know, for your open communications, and to all of our staff here on the committee, you know, especially with our nonpartisan staff, Chelsea Griffin from House Research, Anna Lee from House Fiscal, and then to our partisan staff on the committee, Chelsea Exelson with the GOP, thank you. Jen Nelson with DFL, thank you both. And then to our committee staff, we want to thank our page, Sarah, and the sergeant's office. Thank you to our sergeants at arms for being here today, and especially to my committee staff, our CLA, Abdul Aziz, and our committee administrator, Jenny Nash. Just wanted to know that further meetings of the Capital Investment Committee will be at the call of the chair. Representative Erdahl, I don't know if you want to, you have any quick closing comments before we adjourn today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, thank you for your work on this and, you know, for the communication that we've had. I think we put together a very good bill that passed on March 6th. Hopefully, it'll eventually come back to us, or if not, I remain confident that we are going to get a bill done at some point, whether it's be GO or cash or, you know, all of one or the other, we're going to get something done. And we need to, because the people of Minnesota expect it and the state needs it.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl, for that. And just quick a reminder for all of us and, you know, maybe for our staff to communicate with members that this will be our last committee hearing, and so we won't have any more. And for those of you that are interested, I think that, you know, once we adjourn a session this year, start thinking about any local projects that you would like us to tour in your community and start communicating that to myself, Lead Erdahl, and our committee administrator so that we can get that ready. Thank you, everyone, and the meeting is adjourned.